This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
So we talked about the obligatory parts of prayer, meaning what you have to do. So as a quick recap, we went through the conditions of the prayer. So these were the things that you needed to have prior to entering into the prayer. We did this like a month ago, right? So in order for the prayer to be valid, you need to have these basic things: being in a state of ritual purity, being free from any physical filth, covering one's nakedness, facing in the direction of the Kaaba, the time of the prayer has to have come in, you need to have intention, and then the opening invocation was called the Tahreema. All these things happen before you begin to pray, right? This is a quick recap. And then we talked about this bottom section, which are the integrals of the prayer itself, right? These are what's obligatory, what we call farz. So if you don't have these things, then the prayer isn't valid. It doesn't count. So what we likened this to was a skeleton. So these are the things that if they don't happen in the prayer, then the prayer itself isn't valid. And in the Hanafi school, which is the school we're looking at, there's not a lot that goes into the obligatory aspects of the prayer other than a lot of motions. So you need to do that first invocation, which some people say is a condition, for others that it is a part of the prayer. Second, you're going to be standing if you have the physical capacity to stand, except for voluntary prayers. You're going to recite any part of the Quran, even if it's just a verse. And what we said was the shortest verse in the Quran in Arabic says thumma nadhir, and then he looked. So you don't have to recite the first chapter in its entirety. You don't have to recite entire chapters. This is in its most minute form. So someone is learning how to pray, you're a convert to Islam, you just came back to your faith, you're engaging prayer as somebody who was born into it, and you just are learning it, it's still obligatory upon you, your five daily prayers, right? So some of you in this room were born into this, some of you are converts, some of you are thinking about conversion. The minute someone converts to Islam, then prayer is obligatory upon them. But you're not going to have learned all of it as a prerequisite. That's not something that has to happen in order to convert. Someone can convert without even knowing that there's five daily prayers in Islam. Does that make sense? But now that they're Muslim, yeah, do you have a question?
So you don't have to know how to, like, if you're praying in congregation, do you also have to make your own intention, or it's what the person that's reciting?
Yeah, you make the intention that you're following the person that is leading the prayer. The intention can just be, you can say, I'm intending the same intention as the person leading the prayer, right? If you're praying in congregation, ideally, somebody who is there would have the wherewithal to be able to say, hey, like, this is how you do these basic parts to prayer before they throw you into it. But there could be all kinds of scenarios, right? You could be intimidated. You might have never, like, been around Muslim people before, right? Because if someone converts to Islam, they could convert just sitting in their house, and you don't need somebody to sanctify that process or to have, like, people witness it as such, right? It's still valid. But here, what is a legally excusable reason is what we're talking about, right? So what a lot of people get is what the prayer is in its final form. And what we're doing is going through phases. So as you're doing this, you recite even that short portion, you're gonna bow, prostrate, and have a final sitting. That suffices while you are still learning the prayer in its entirety. Then the next section that we looked at were the necessary acts, what are called the wajib acts. So this is kind of like the flesh, the meat of the prayer, right? That was the skeleton. This is what we're going to continue to do a deep dive into. So we looked at, in the first one, instead of just doing like an invocation of some kind, you are specifically saying Allahu Akbar. You're going to recite the first chapter, Surah Fatiha, as well as three verses, like short verses or one long verse. In these ways, it's also a necessary act. And we're going to do some of that today, because that's the last piece of the necessary parts, the wajib parts, that we haven't gone through yet. We're going to go through two short chapters, and then everything that goes into the necessary acts, we would have covered over the course of these sessions this summer. If you missed any of them, you can go on our podcast or YouTube channel and still get access to them. But these are the things you want to be learning right now, right? If you haven't memorized the first chapter, what is Fatiha here in point two, then you want to work on that. And you want to work on learning you want to learn some verses of the Quran as outlined here as well. We're going to look at two short chapters that are easy to memorize, right? You just go at a pace that makes sense for you. And the rest of it, again, is going to be things that are rooted in stuff we've already went through. So this eighth point, reciting the tashahhud, we talked about this last week. If you remember, we went through it in its entirety. At-tahiyyatu lillahi wa salawatu wa tayyibat, right? For those who are here, if you missed it, it's up online. We went through each word, what it meant, and kind of distilled it, not just its translation, but giving an opportunity to relate to the meaning, right? Because sometimes even the translation can be pretty antiquated or archaic. And so you can find all of it online. If you missed some of those, let me know. We can get on a Zoom. We can meet up and go through it also. And then what we're going to look at through the course of next week are just some of the parts that are recommended. This is kind of what ornaments the prayer and beautifies it. You know, so how you raise your hands when you do that initial tahrima, that first invocation, Allahu Akbar, it's a recommended, where you're going to put your hands after, you know, all of these kinds of things. And there's a lot of those. So we're going to do that at the end. Some of it is going to be still attached to postures. Some of it is going to be attached to phrases that you're going to recite. But from now through the end of the summer, what you want to work on are these parts, these integral parts. You go back and listen to the audio from the few weeks that we went really deep into the first chapter, Fatiha. And today we're going to do a more cursory analysis of two short chapters, and that will bring us to a close on all of the necessary acts, that second tier of acts that are part of the prayer. Does that make sense? Yeah? Is everybody with me?
Yes.
Yeah. So we went through all of the obligatory parts to it. We are going to today wrap up on what are going to be all of the necessary acts, which in Arabic are called the wajib acts, the wajibat. And then next week, we'll go through a list of the recommended acts. There's not a lot that's there that has a lot of Arabic to it and long phrases, other than one part, which is a prayer on the Prophet Abraham and the Prophet Muhammad and their family, peace be upon them all, and then a short supplication that happens after that. But the crux of it is going to be in these points right here. Does that make sense? Any questions on that? You sure? Yes? Yeah? Why are you smiling in the back? Do you have a question? No? Yeah. Okay, great. So the first one we're going to look at is a short chapter. It's called Surah Al-Kawthar. And this is the 108th chapter of the Quran. And so it's really short, three verses. One of the chapters that you want to acquaint yourself with. It's got a lot of deep meaning to it, but in and of itself, easy to memorize. If you meet people who have been praying for years, like your everyday Muslim, there's a good chance they're reading this chapter regularly in their prayer, right? I can see you smiling under your face mask. Yeah, she knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. So the shorter chapter versus the longer chapter doesn't necessarily have a comparison from a standpoint of merit or blessing as such, right? Within the standpoint of a metaphysical understanding of the recitation of these verses, the entire text in and of itself is seen by Muslims as being a noble text. And there's unique blessings through the engagement of each individual verse and chapters on a whole, as well as segmented uniquely. But in and of itself, you're in a place where you don't want to think about your relationship to prayer in that way. That becomes self-deprecating or demeaning. There's narrations in the prophetic tradition where there were people who were particularly known for just reciting the shorter chapters of the Quran regularly and consistently in the course of their prayer. And other people would sometimes complain about them to the Prophet and say that this guy just recites the same thing again and again and again. And it was always some of the shorter chapters. And the Prophet would ask, you know, why would you recite these chapters? And the man would say that they love to recite this chapter, right? It gives them the most insight into, you know, God is the most merciful. And that's going to be the second one we look at. It's called Ikhlas, sincerity. But we're going to look at this one first, Al-Kawthar. Is anyone familiar with this? Have you read this chapter before or its translation? Yeah, it's okay if you haven't. So contextually, what's happening here, because all of this is historically contextualized in real time. So the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was someone who was not survived by any of his male children. He had daughters, and the Meccan society was a society that had its own challenges. Amongst them, they practiced the abhorrent practice of female infanticide, right? They wanted to have sons. They didn't want to have daughters. They'd bury women alive, literally. And Islam came to abolish practices like these and other abusive, you know, practices against women. But because the Prophet didn't have any male offspring that survived, the people of Mecca, they were quite often mocking, ridiculing, abusing him, especially in that early period of revelation. This was something that was quite customary of prophets of God across the board, that their early followers tended to be those who came from lower social classes, did not have the utmost of authority, etc. And in the Muslim experience, it wasn't that different. And so the last verse of this that we'll look at has a word that says abtar, which means to cut off, right? So they would say to the Prophet that he's cut off, but in a derogatory sense, that it's beyond his capacity to have like children in this way. And it wasn't at a time also that was just in passing, but in real time, the Prophet is burying his children as they have passed. He's lost like his loved ones, and they continue to mock and continue to ridicule and use it as an opportunity to be demeaning, right? The society in and of itself that Islam was introduced to had positives and negatives like any society, but amongst the challenges that it had, it was a very stratified society that didn't have a structured mode of governance. The way we have a mayor of New York City, there's no mayor of Mecca, right? There's no governor of Mecca at that time. The way that things were built out were based off of a very deeply tribalistic structure, and lineage in and of itself was a primary variable to determine who was kind of more elite or noble as such. The challenge that came, the Prophet Muhammad was part of a tribe called the Quraysh. It was a noble tribe, and he had elders in his family that were also of nobility, and other Meccan tribes couldn't do anything to him. as a result of that, until one of his uncles passes away, and then the mocking and demeaningness and abuse becomes that much more hostile and aggressive. But this is one of the things that is happening here. And so if we do a breakdown of this, the first word says inna. So in Arabic, we're reading from right to left. The transliteration is still written in English words that are worded left to right. But the way this sentence is going this way, the Arabic you want to read this way. So inna is just like a word that's emphatic, right? It's giving like this sense of whatever is coming after this, it's very much so deeply emphasized, right? And the na at the end is donating like kind of a royal we, right? So this is God speaking. A'tainaka. A'tainaka is a sense of like giving something. But when you're giving, utilizing this form of giving, it's giving in such a way that is really beyond the expectation of the person that is being given something. Do you know? And the ka at the end is a suffix pronoun. It means you. So he's speaking to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, al-kawthar. Now this word al-kawthar, a lot of people will translate in different ways. This says, we have truly given abundance to you, O Prophet. There's a fountain in that's mentioned in our tradition, that's in the hereafter. It's a fountain given to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Something that he will have people drink from, you know, when they are risen from their graves, etc. But the Arabic of it, that form, if I write here, can people see? Yeah, can you all see if I write here?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so the way Arabic works as a language, we've talked about this before, but just to reiterate, like you have three letters, fa, ala, right? That they make forms, and letters get plugged into the form. And the form then denotes like grammatically a meaning of something. So if you have fa'il, for example, this is like the form that's given for somebody that does something, you know? So you have words like alim falls into this fa'il form, alim. That's like a scholar, someone who is a person of knowledge. Does that make sense? Right? My name is Khalid. It falls into this form, right? And has that same kind of notion there. So the word here, kawthar, I'll write it in English so it's more easily understood. This form is used to denote just like a lot of things to begin with, right? So in Arabic, one of the ways you say stars is you say kawkab, right? And you can see it's got the same kind of like syllables and pronunciation. Kawthar, kawkab. Does that make sense so far?
Yes.
Right? So this isn't just like a few stars. It's like a ton of stars. You know, my wife and my kids and I, we were invited to a wedding in Lake Tahoe a few weeks ago. I don't know if any of you have ever been outside of the city where you can actually see the stars. In some parts of Manhattan, you can see it. I was in Brooklyn a couple of weeks ago, and we prayed our sunset prayer in the park, and over there you could also see the stars. It was crazy. But when you go to like some parts of the country, all you can see is stars in the sky. It's like remarkable when you see that. There's no clouds. You're in places where the air quality isn't terrible. And when we were in Nevada going to Lake Tahoe, all you could see in the sky was like these beautiful like stars. It was crazy how many you could see. That's like kawkab, you know? It's just like tons of stars. Does that make sense? So the same way there's tons of stars, kawthar has that same kind of connotation, and it has in it the letters kathara, which is denoting like many things, right? It means like a lot to begin with. So that's where the idea of abundance is. Meaning, like, you've been given so many blessings. You have so many things in your life that are good, that are meaningful, that you want to be mindful of, you want to remember. The things with the Quran is that it's got application that has relevance through all of its words to each one of its readers. And this is a big theme and value within Islam, the idea of appreciation and gratitude, right? And the recognition not simply just of the gift or the blessing, but taking it to its most logical conclusion to also then, through the recognition of the gift or blessing, to be able to remember and recognize the giver of the gift, the giver of the blessing. So it's not just that here I am in a place where it's like, so great to have a marker, right? Or I love having a laptop or an iPad. But I also then, by extension, understand that this came to me from someplace. And what's happening here is that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is in like a very heavy, difficult phase of his prophethood. He's got a lot of stuff that's very hard going on in his life. This is something that's characteristic of the prophets of God, that their relationship to their own faith, their relationship to their own spiritual struggle, is going to come with challenges, heaviness, difficulty. And as a mechanism of being able to deal with that, the opportunity is to not be rooted in kind of a delusional state of self that says there's nothing hard in my life, but the appreciation and gratitude becomes a means of a vision modifier of the challenge. It helps me to see it differently, like what lies ahead of me. Does that make sense? And so here, like, the verse is saying, you've been given so much. There's so much that you have that's actually of bounty and blessing. Things that you don't want to think in absolutes. If somebody says to you to practice gratitude, it doesn't mean that you're either grateful or an ingrate, right? That you can only exist in these two frames. There's like so much more that goes on in between. Do you know what I mean? And that's what happens quite often. You're only either this or the absolute opposite. That person is only either this or the other opposite. You're either like nice to me or you're the worst thing in the world, right? You're either like kind or you're terrible. You're either good or you're bad. Do you know? It doesn't only work in these kind of simplistic frames. And here, he's telling the prophet of God, like, hey, you've been given a lot. You have many things that you can account for, that you can see as being of a blessing. And for everybody, because it's a short chapter, right? And you want to think, this deep message that's rooted in this, that Muslims everywhere read this in a lot of their prayers, they're saying it again and again and again, this idea that I've been given more than sometimes I want to admit. I have a lot more than sometimes I realize. I don't recognize all of the bounties. I don't recognize all of the gifts. I don't recognize all of the blessings. The opportunity to reflect on that and to contemplate on that gets attached to the next verse that's going to come up. But this deliberate process of understanding this, like, you have it and it's been given to you. And this is also an important thing to understand. Within an Islamic understanding of how this world works, we talked about the first chapter, Surah Fatiha, the opening, and one of the ways that God identifies himself is Maliki Yawmiddin, right? The master of the day of judgment. In Islam, God is the owner of all things. So anything that we've been given is actually in that way. Like, it's been given to us. And just because it's been given to us doesn't mean that we deserve it. The notion that we have it isn't by anything of our own doing, but just as God is saying to his prophet that indeed we have given to you an abundance of blessings and bounty, the same thing gets applicable to all of us. That you're able to see everything with a certain sense of real dignity because you know that you've been given it as a gift. The spouse that you have, the child that you have, the clothes that you have, the food that you have. Right? I've used this example in other settings, but when the weather started to change here in New York and it got very hot, it was very humid, right? You all remember the beginning part of the summer, last few days, you know, alhamdulillah, thank God, it's been a little cooler on different days of the week, right? Some days have been just like super sticky and really gross. And when we went from it being like spring to that drastic change of summer and the heat wave, I was walking in Washington Square Park and I ran into a guy who was in the sea of everything. Like some of you walk through Washington Square Park, you know what it's like in that park, right? And this guy was in the park and is hot and he's got 5 layers of clothes on. And you also know, like, people in New York can be really kind or they can be terrible. When you see somebody that is out of the ordinary, the assumption can quite often be to elevate oneself by denigrating somebody else, right? It's a very unhealthy way of seeing the world. And so this person, you engage him. And you're like, why are you wearing all these clothes? He says, I don't have any place to put my clothes. And if I don't keep them all with me, I don't know if I leave them behind where I'll be able to come across something like this again down the line. So if I don't have this long sleeve shirt on and this jacket, what am I going to do if it gets cold at night? If I don't have the hoodie to protect myself from rain and other things, what am I going to do if it starts to rain on me and I'm sleeping outside? Do you get what I'm saying? What we can draw from verses like this and deepen in our own reflection is a question that can make a lot of people uncomfortable, but something that Islam is constantly telling its practitioner, why do I deserve what I have more than what that guy has been given? Like, what did I fundamentally do differently? That somehow he doesn't even have a place to put his clothes. And I have clothes that I don't even know that I have them. You get what I mean? And the awareness and the consciousness is rooted just in this short phrase. That you've been given so much. What is it that you are in a place of real kind of difficulty around? You have opportunity to make sense of life through a prism of positivity. So choose positivity. Don't choose negativity. Understand that in whatever one's saying that you don't have, like, we have given to you certain things. Do you get what I mean? Inna a'tainaka al-kawthar. You just sometimes sit and you reflect. COVID was really important. I was in Toronto the other weekend. And this guy was driving me to the airport. And he said, he's been to New York. So he's like, COVID was really bad in Canada. And I never had a conversation with him before. And he said, I heard in New York, it was really good. Nothing was a problem. Right? And I looked at him. I was like, are you being sarcastic? And he was like, no, that's what my friends told me. That in New York, everything was fine. And I was like, I don't know who your friends are. But if they were like super rich, they might have just gotten up and left New York. And then they were fine. But New York was like crazy in COVID, right? Our Islamic Center community in the first few weeks had 100 people pass away, either directly or people lost loved ones, and we just stopped counting. Let alone in the first however many weeks, 30,000 people died in New York, right? Funeral systems were all strained, food insecurity, people were now stuck at home, survivors with their abusers, like the kind of like crazy stuff. And I said, how is it here? He was like, nobody even remembers COVID. And when COVID was happening, and we were on live streams, and if you were part of this community back then, I was telling people, they're going to try to make you forget everything that you're learning about yourself during this time. You're sitting in your home. You don't really need like to shop as much as you do. You don't really need to eat out as much as you do. You don't really need like as much of the things that they tell you you need. And you can just sit within your spaces and try to really think. All of this other stuff that's sitting around you, what is it doing for you now that the world is falling apart? And most people, they don't remember anymore that they don't really need all that stuff. Or be able to recognize the things that they were surrounded with that they've also now forgotten. And this verse is saying, like, have wakefulness. Be in a place where you can recognize all of the gifts that you have been endowed with. Inna a'tayna kal-kawthar, we have given you so much. You have a lot more than at times you might realize. Do you get what I'm saying? Great. Let's continue. In the next verse, it says, Fasalli li rabbika wanhar. So it's connected to the verse before. You've been given a lot of stuff. You have a lot of bounty, blessing. It doesn't mean you don't have difficulty in your life, right? It's not a religion that is devoid of reality. You can have tough things, but recognizing what's good helps to dispel and confront the difficulty more, right? The sea of negativity that's overwhelming and overlooming can be really hard when you also have this absolute rhetoric that everything is terrible, you know? Fasalli, so the word for prayer, which is what we've been talking about for the last however many months, right, is salah. The fa that's there in the beginning is saying, as a connector to what was before. So essentially what it's saying is you have been given a lot of things, so because you were given a lot of things, then do this thing. And what it's saying to do because you were given a lot is salli. Like, do your salah. Pray your prayers. لِرَبِّكَ, to your Lord. And when we talked about the first chapter, we broke down etymologically what the word Rabb means. Not just Lord, but if you were to open up an Arabic dictionary, the word Rabb is going to have a definition, and it's going to say that Rabb is Malik, that he's the owner, the possessor, right? So, like, I could own the laptop, right? Rabb is Sayyid. He's the one that makes the decisions. So just because I own the TV in my house doesn't mean I get to decide what's being watched on the TV. My kids are deciding what's on the TV, right? Sayyid is the one that's also making the decisions. Rabb is Murabbi, right? The caretaker, the nurturer, the one that rears you and cultivates you. That there's a prayer in the Quran that says, وَقُلْ رَبِّ ارْحَمْهُمَا كَمَا رَبَّيَانِي صَغِيرًا. And, you know, be merciful to them as they did nurture me when I was young, in reference to one's parents, right? Rabbayani is the same word, right? Rabb. So that nurturing, kind of caretaking. Al-Mun'im is Rabb, the giver of ni'mah, of blessings, of gifts. That Rabb is the healer of all things, you know? So much more. That's all in this, right? So if you're going to pray, like, pray to that God. Because he's the one that gave you all of it in the beginning, right? He's the one is the giver of these gifts, the giver of these bounties. Inna a'tayna kal-kawthar, because we gave you so much, because of that, then do your prayer. Li rabbika, to your Rabb, wanhar. We have like two major holidays in Islam. There's after Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr, some of you joined us for in the park. It's a conclusion, and it's kind of a day of feasting, a holiday at the end of our month of fasting. And then around the Hajj time, we have what's called Eid al-Adha, and the Hajj commemorates the rites and kind of life of the Prophet Abraham and his family. And that day of Eid, around Hajj time, is also called Yom al-Nahr, the day of sacrifice, right? In the kind of Abrahamic narrative of sacrifice, Nahr is sacrifice in that way, the ritual sacrifice. In the Quran, quite often, when you have like the word Salah, you have it paired with the word Zakah, right? So you pray and you give in charity. right? And so this follows a similar construct. Like, you're going to pray, and then you're going to go do something to support people in need. Because when you do the ritual slaughter in the day of Eid, a part of the meat is meant to be distributed to people in need who otherwise wouldn't have, like, sometimes food to eat at all, let alone, like, have meat that they might be able to eat. I've been to refugee camps in the world. Went to Myanmar a couple of times where people are facing ethnic cleansing and genocide. And the two times I went, the first time I went shortly after that day of Eid, Eid al-Adha, and 10 months later I went shortly before that holiday. And the second time I went, there was people that I met who, when I asked them what they would like, they said, "We would really love to be able to give our children." We're survivors of genocide, right? They're not just, like, they're survivors of ethnic cleansing. The holiday's coming. They want to celebrate it. They say, "We'd really love to be able to give them something different." In the 10 months between I had gone visit one and visit two, all of these people had eaten rice 3 times a day as a meal. That's just the only thing they had to eat. They ate it. I was like, "What?" And they ate it with gratitude. You know what I mean? Right? It's remarkable. I went to Turkey after the earthquake. I went to all these other places. Everybody's still in a place where it's not shattering their connection to God, right? They're still praising God. They're still saying God's wisdom beyond our own, you know? And not with a sense of just, "Let me sit and do nothing." They're still getting things done, but they see it in a mode of existence that's kind of bigger than just what the ego sometimes offers. So, inna atainaka al-kawthar, fasalli lirabbika wanhar. So that nahar is being referenced there, and it kind of conjoins this idea of, like, you're going to pray, you're going to go do these elements that have social equity to them, right? You're going to engage in an act of ritual prayer and then another act of ritual worship that's of charity. You're going to go and help people in their time of need. Does that make sense? Yeah. And then at the end of it, it says, inna, indeed, shaniyaka. So that word is in reference to the people who oppose the messenger of God, who are saying all these derogatory things about him, right? Some people will say this is a man in specific by the name of Abu Lahab. Some people say it's a man by the name of Abu Jahl. Like, they're literally speaking terrible things about him. This other, the end of the verse says, huwa abtar, that they are the ones who are cut off, right? Like, I don't want to go into it explicitly, but they're saying this in the context. They're saying to him that he is abtar. He is cut off in the sense that he can't have male children. You know, they're saying that there's, like, physical, like, deformities. They're mocking him, you know, at the level of his manhood, masculinity, all of these kinds of things. Does that make sense? And so here, as a source of support and comfort, God is saying the ones who oppose you, they're the ones that are cut off. But the abtar, within the understanding of our framework, is a cut off from, like, a blessing. That they're making themselves devoid through their behavior, their lack of character, their lack of integrity, their mocking, their ridiculing, their arrogance, their indifference, from blessings of different kinds. And if you were to put the chapter in and of itself all together, the whole idea is giving you now a spectrum of lived experience that someone could have. Because the people who are saying these things about the Prophet Muhammad, they're like the elite, the nobles. They have wealth, they have clout, they have power. But what are they doing with it? And they still fall into this space where everything that they were given isn't because of their own work and their own effort, but they're not able to acknowledge the source of what's being given to them. And because they have this sense that I deserve it, I worked hard, that's why it was given to me, I'm better than these other people, that's why they don't have it, right? It's not very different than how you see a lot of how supremacy builds itself up in most global contexts, even in this country, right? You think about whiteness and anti-blackness and stratification of society and what goes into this, and people alleging that because they have power and privilege, that is in some theological systems an indication that God's favor is upon them, and that God's favor is not upon one
who is not given like wealth and affluence and influence. Islamic theology doesn't function in that way. It doesn't indicate that by virtue of the amount of money you have or the titles that you have or the worldly success that you have, that that means that you are closer to God. If anything, what the Quran teaches us and what the prophetic example echoes again and again and again is that the people who don't have so much in this world, they're the ones who are going to have a lot more ease in the world beyond this one, right? But when you relate like all of the words together, the recognition of gratitude of what you've been given, if you really like are grateful for what you have, it's going to be hard for you to mistreat people, right? Like people who can really appreciate what's been given to them, they're not going to like be the people who are racist or arrogant or xenophobic or any of these kinds of things. And people had like this prescription written here. You don't want to mistreat people. You want to be the person who says hello to everyone and acknowledges their presence and all of these kinds of things. Well, like start recognizing what you've been given, right? Build up consciousness through that prism of gratitude and positivity. It renders contentment inside. When you have actual contentment, not fleeting happiness in a consumer-driven society, but real contentment inwardly, it's going to be hard to treat people like garbage, you know? And when you can do this and recognize the gratitude, the reflection and contemplation, make it concrete. The prescription is there by going and praying to God, thanking Him for what He's given to you, and then sharing with others of what you have in whatever capacity you can. So this short chapter is one of the ones that I'd recommend that you start to memorize in relation to what we were talking about, when we were over here on point number two, to recite the Fatiha, as well as a chapter or three verses after it, in any two units of the obligatory prayer and in all of the units of the voluntary prayer, right? This is a necessary act in the Hanafi school, a wajib act. It's not a fard, so you want to reasonably start learning this so you can memorize it and inculcate it into your prayer. And as you're learning more, you're able to then start to add more to your memorization and recitation of things. The other one that we wanted to look at that is a part of this is another short chapter, and this chapter 112, and it's called Surah Ikhlas. Can people see that? This chapter is a really great base of like theology in Islam. What is foundational theology in Islam as a religion? And it's very simple. Contextually, what's happening is that in different occasions, people are asking the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, about like the God that he worships. What is he made of? How is he built? Who are his children? Who is he the child of? And so the chapter is giving an understanding of who God is from an Islamic standpoint, right? When one converts to Islam, they're affirming two foundational theologies, a very pure monotheism. There's just one God in Islam, but distinct from other monotheistic traditions, in the essence of who God is, right? And this chapter gives a lot of insight into that. It's very short. And the second aspect of that affirmation of the Shahada, when one converts, is the prophethood of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And so we're gonna go through this one really quickly too. So it starts by saying, say, qul, huwa, he, Allah, ahad, that say he is Allah, the One. So ahad doesn't denote just one in the concept of like one eraser, right? Or one table. This would be wahid in Arabic. Ahad is denoting a little bit more of a uniqueness in that oneness of God. The word ahad is not something that denotes divisibility, for example. So like this is one marker, right? But it's made up of parts that can be separated. Ahad is denoting something that is not made up of parts in this way, right? Like the chair can be broken down, the table can be broken down, the car can be broken down. In Islam, the knowledge of God that we have is a negative knowledge. It's not negative in the sense that it's pessimistic, but it's negative in the sense that we understand who God is by knowing what it is that he is not. That God is completely other than his creation. There's a verse that says, "Laysa kamithlihi shay," that there's not anything that's like a likeness to God. Mm-hmm. So anything that you would conceptualize God to be, you know that God is other than that. Ahad is also not made plural. It's just ahad. Uniquely one, in the sense that there's nothing that is like God, right? This is what is being said here. And in real time, the Prophet is having this conversation with individuals who are trying to understand through the parameters of their theology. This is something that comes up for a lot of people, especially those who are looking at Islam as a religion, and they've come from a religious background. Or for some of us, when we don't study theology, which there's a difference between faith and creed. Creed are codified systems that you can memorize, but it doesn't necessarily denote that you believe in it, right? Like we could go to the Department of Islamic Studies at NYU, which is two blocks down, and there's professors who likely know a lot more about this stuff than I do, but they're not Muslim, you know? They're in a place where they've memorized, but the faith aspect isn't there. Do you get what I'm saying? Right? So it's not like a knowledge base that's like that, right? The two also don't go hand in hand necessarily, but there's some relationship there. So here, this is like point number one. God is just one in Islam, and his oneness is unique in every which way that you can understand that oneness to be. He is Ahad. I'm just going to go through it really quick. Just so we can get to a couple of other things. Allah al-Samad, that he is the eternal, the absolute. When we talk about Samad, we're talking about Samad in a way that this kind of gives some definition, but it's really denoting like a source of refuge. That God is the one you turn to in moments of crisis and moments of need. And when you look at the two verses together, quite often in the Quran, stylistically, what you have when there are divine names of God introduced, they in pairs are giving like different ways of understanding. So Ahad is telling us an essential quality of God. Samad is telling us how God relates to his creation. God is like the source of refuge. God is the one that you are turning to in your times of need. He's in this existence that is different, as these people are now asking the Prophet questions like, is your God made of copper? Is your God made of gold? Is your God made of stone? And there's a chapter in the Quran that's called Anam that has a verse that says very explicitly that Muslims are not supposed to mock people for their beliefs. Like, you don't make fun of people for their religion, their theological points that are different from your own. So that's not like the points of the conversation. But they are looking at things through their frame. So the second point that I'd want to say here is that this happens a lot. When people have been socialized in a certain way, they're understanding things through their lived experience and terminology. So you might go talk to someone who is Christian or Jewish, or you yourself looking at Islam might be coming from a background of another religious upbringing, and you've been socialized in a way where it's hard to mute what you were given directly and indirectly because it comes up. Like, the concept of God in Islam is very different from other religions. The concept of a prophet in Islam is very different from other religions, right? Who God is in his essence is very different. Do you get what I mean? But here, these people are talking to the prophet from the standpoint of what they are accustomed to. And he's speaking to them as someone who has come from that demographic, able to answer in a language that they understand, right? Quite often, because there's some of us in the room who are born into Islam, we don't know how to talk to people, not in the standpoint of proselytization, which is not like this religion's goal in that way. We're not a religion that stands on the corner just like trying to quantify like people's conversions, you know? It's about a qualified aspect in every which way. But here, like, the prophet's having a conversation in real time with his people, and he's able to speak to them with an understanding of the context that they're coming from. Do you know? When people come to talk to you, they haven't gone through everything that you've gone through. They haven't lived every way that you've lived, right? Somebody walks in, and this is why I was saying, even in the way we teach prayer, we don't teach people like phases to get to an end result. We teach them the last set as like the beginning, and it's overwhelming, right? But you gotta talk to people and recognize where they're coming from. And then he says, "Lam yalid wa lam yulad," that God, he does not beget, nor is he begotten. Meaning, God doesn't have children, nor was he born of like another entity, right? And this becomes a problematic theology within Islam, that there's no associating of partners with God in any capacity, nor is there a notion that God has this relationship to other gods or like deified individuals in some way, shape, or form, right? In a Meccan society, there were like tons of deities and tons of gods that were worshipped. Their entire system economically was rooted in a lot of this, but they had a theology that was rooted in the idea that God can have children, that gods can be born of other deities as well. In an Islamic standpoint, it is something that is just off the table, you know, for a variety of reasons. Like, God in his essence is seen as the all-powerful, for example, right? The all-knowing. There's two gods. Like, how does this work? You know, where and how do we kind of make sense of this in these ways? And so this becomes like another kind of point theologically that makes Islam different. وَلَمْ يَكُلْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدْ, and there's not for him an equivalent of anyone, right? So the word kufuwan is kind of the key word in this part of the verse. Like in marriage, in Islam, this is a quality that people are told to look for in a spouse, like somebody you're compatible with, right? Somebody that you are kind of in a similar place and background. Doesn't mean that you only marry people from your culture or your race or like your home village or any of these kinds of things, right? Or that you require that. Because that's just racism when you think that someone can't be in your family because of their different backgrounds or these kinds of things, right? But here, that equivalency is utilized in those ways. You know, that you want to have somebody that's kind of similar to you in some capacity that you're getting married to. You know, you're going to have things in common, compatibility. Here, like the verse is saying, there's nothing that is similar to God. There's nothing that has that remote equivalency to the divine. And so for a lot of people, like, scholars, they'll say, if someone reflects on this chapter, they understand its meaning, it becomes sufficient for them in terms of what they would need in order to have a base understanding of the concept of the divine in Islam. This chapter and the chapter we looked at before are two short chapters. They have a lot of deep meaning to them. You want to spend some time engaging them, memorizing, like learning them piece by piece. A lot of the words repeat themselves, and they're short verses, they're short lines, so that they're going to be easier to memorize. This site that we're on, Quran.com, if you hit the play button on these, it'll play the verses for you. Right, you can just hit listen to it again and again. You go on YouTube, there's some videos that are up there that like literally have these shorter chapters on repeat like 10 times, 50 times, 100 times. And they're short, so you can just hear it again and again, and it'll help in the memorization of it, so you can add it to the prayer. Does that make sense? Any questions on that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we've gone through all of the necessary acts, the wajib acts, right? So in relation to the obligatory acts, that you're entering into the prayer, there's a standing, right? These things all still keep carrying over in the prayer, right? So there's a standing, the recitation of the Quran, even if just one verse, right? So this was the short verse, ثُمَّ نَذِرْ. If you say that, it suffices from the validity of the prayer, from an obligatory standpoint, right? You're new to Islam, you're just learning the prayer, this is where you want to start. And then outside of the prayer, you're memorizing these other chapters that we've gone through, right? The first chapter, Fatiha, the 108th chapter, Al-Kawthar, and the 112th chapter, Al-Ikhlas. You're going to have the bowing, the prostrating, and the final sitting. And then in the necessary acts, you're going to begin by saying Allahu Akbar, the recitation of the first chapter, Fatiha, as well as a chapter of three verses after it, in these settings. Perform the prostration, the second prostration, to be still between like each in the movement and not kind of being like rushed. And you're going to have that first sitting as well, reading the entire tashahhud that we talked about last week, and saying the word as-salam, right? And then there's other things that we're going to get into that you've likely seen people do in their prayer, right? If we look at the postures here, for example, that the person leading the prayer says the takbirs out loud. You're going to say these takbirs when you're going into these positions. In the bowing and in the prostrating, there's like certain litanies that we recite in those times. These are all from recommended acts that we'll go through in the coming weeks. That is going to be like a long list of things that we're going through. That's why we wanted to kind of space it out. But you want to be like memorizing these other parts at a pace that like literally every day you could just learn a word, right? And then within a week, you know about a verse and a half, like, you know, two verses, depending on which chapter you're looking at. And you're kind of utilizing the opportunity to also think and reflect upon it in your own accord. So it's kind of giving you meaning, and it's not just the recitation of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we're going to go into this next section that is on the emphasized sunnahs of the prayer. And after that, these are like just basic things that we'll look at. We'll talk about in the emphasized sunnahs, like two more things that we're going to memorize. We'll look at briefly the things that invalidate the prayer. So, you know, there's things that can break your prayer. Right, so for example, if you start speaking in your prayer, like that's not something you're allowed to do in your prayer, right? You know, if you're gonna eat or drink or these kinds of things, some of them we're gonna explain a little bit more so it doesn't kind of create like hecticness. But you basically can't do something in your prayer that is going to make it seem like it's an action outside of the prayer. And then things that are disliked in the prayer. But the crux of it is going to be focused on the recommended acts in the coming week. And we will pick up from there then next week.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.